Play Speed Nation, welcome again to this special limited series podcast. I'm, of course, Jambalaya Jake Williams. I'm joined by my buddy Tyler Kelly as we are continuing on our journey going through our GWCW match list. So in this episode, we'll be covering matches 40 through 31. So we're getting down to the nitty-gritty. Only 40 matches left, only a couple more. So we have four episodes left, this one, and then three more after. So we are getting really into, I think at this point, the matches that are really, really, I think what most would consider like all-time great matches that I think a lot of people probably got multiple votes, multiple ballots in for, that sort of thing. So without further ado, I'll bring in my my partner here, Tyler Kelly. What's going on, Tyler?
Oh, not much, Jake. Had a good weekend. The weather's turning nice here, and I'm ready to kind of get into this the creme de la creme here of some of these WCW matches.
Absolutely. So I think we should just roll right into it. Tyler, you want to kick us off?
I will do so. My number 40 match is the Rock and Roll Express versus Ole and Arn Anderson for the NWA Tag Team titles in a steel cage match from Starrcade 1986. So, Jake, I think we were almost in lockstep on this one, because I have down that you had it at number 49, and it's my number 40, so we almost talked about it in the same episode. And with good reason, it's a great match. The voters over at Place to Be Nation, where the results are dropping every Friday, and by the time you hear this, I believe the final results will be the next Friday, so be looking for that. But this match finished number 35, so right around where we had it. So the Rock and Rolls are the tag team champs here, and they're very over, as they always are, but 86 was really one of their peak times. So I mentioned it was a cage match, and it's just chaos right from the start. Both teams are going nonstop, and this is really the culmination of a feud that lasted most of 1986 with the Rock and Roll Express and the Horsemen. And we'll be talking about some of those matches later as well. So the announcers make it a point to say that Ricky has some scars from some of those matches, or that come into play in some of those matches. Robert missed a high knee to the cage, and the Andersons just rammed the leg into the cage, and they start working it. And Robert's kind of your face in peril number one as they work the leg over. But that doesn't last too long, as he makes the hot tag to Ricky, who's on fire for a few seconds before the Andersons take back over. But the crowd's still just chanting rock and roll all the time. And soon enough, Ricky's bleeding, and he gets cheese grated on both sides of the cage. They're just really working that cut, working him over on the cage. Ricky's bleeding a ton, and the announcers are saying he's fighting for his life while the Andersons are working the arm and the shoulder. And again, the crowd's just chanting rock and roll kind of all the way throughout the match. Ricky makes a comeback, but Ole just lawn darts into the cage when all four men are in. And Ricky's just got a crimson mask going, and he hits a knee lift. But Arn grabs him to prevent the tag and tags out to Ole. Like, that was a really good false hot tag there. And Ricky falls against the ropes. Ricky falls against the ropes, and Arn pounces, just hammering that shoulder again. And Arn tags in and hits a spine buster for two, with Robert saving. And Ole comes off the top rope with a knee to Ricky's shoulder, while Arn holds him and then puts him in an arm bar. The ref asks if he wants to give it up, and Ricky just is shouting, he's screaming no, and that, you know, the crowd is again just rock and roll, and Ricky fires up with a series of punches, and Arn's stooging, and Ricky just almost makes the tag, but Ole cuts him off, and Ricky's fighting him off with one arm. He won't say die, gets a small package, but Ole saves, so Robert comes into the ring and saves, and all four are in the ring. The ref tries to get Robert out, but then he turns to Arn while Ole picks up Ricky for a slam, and Robert drop kicks Ricky into the pin on Ole. So I just thought that was an incredible creative finish and a rare match with really no hot tag for the finish. So this was just everything I love about wrestling: the heat, brutality, the blood, the baby face is fighting against all odds and trying things. So, you know, this is just very much the Southern Tag formula, but it may be about as well as it's ever been done, or I thought so anyway, Jake.
Yeah, the execution is just fantastic in this one. And like you talked about, and I think it's what you would expect in this with the Rock and Rolls like taking a shit kicking, which it is a fantastic one. But to me, almost a highlight of this match was Ole. Ole, somebody through doing this project and also the couple times I've been on Croc and Roll with Sean, go check out that podcast. But he's somebody I've really, and I think he sometimes it's because the real life Ole is not the most popular guy, but as far as a wrestler, I've really come to enjoy him as a wrestler, and I almost felt like he was the star of this match. I mean, the Rock and Rolls do their thing. They're always great, and they take a great ass-kicking, like I said, and their selling is great, but man, he was just such a beast in this one. Like, to me, he's the one who really got over the brutality, like you mentioned, Todd. I think that's the perfect word for it, the brutality of this match, and I feel like he really got it over. Like, they're obviously selling, but man, he just looked like such a beast in this match. Like, they always do, but I thought they kicked it up a notch. The Andersons did in this one. Like just the way he was beating their ass. Like, he just felt like he was laying everything in just a little bit harder than he normally would. And I just thought he was fantastic in this one. Like cutting off Ricky and throwing him into the cage. Like, I just thought everything he did in this was fantastic. But just echoing everything you said, Todd, it's just a great kind of old school Southern Tag where it's just, you know, it just shows you where you know, there's one thing, it's the way you structure the match, but it's also just the way you execute it and the way that these guys, you know, the way they can do things that maybe others, if they do the same thing, it doesn't get over quite as well. Like, these guys are all just masters of it. The Rock and Rolls are just great. Like you said, Todd, the fact that they're so over that the crowd never, because I mean, they're really selling for a pretty significant amount of time here, and the crowd never loses it. Like you said, they just keep on with the Rock and Roll chants. Like, they never fade on them. They never lose hope that the Rock and Rolls are going to come back, or they just, you know what I mean? They never get bored with it because they're just so behind him and they're so good at selling it. Like, I love when Ricky comes in, he starts throwing the jabs. It's really awesome. The breakdown at the end, I thought how things kind of break down to the finish was just excellent kind of control chaos. It's a fantastic match. I love this pairing. I actually had them even higher in another match later on in the list. So I was right here with you. You got it a bit higher than me, but we were, like you said, same ballpark. And kind of what I mentioned on the top of the show, really getting into some like top tier stuff here as we get into the like the top 40.
Yeah, absolutely. Just keep rolling with it. And what's your number 40, Jake?
So my number 40. So I rewatched this for this podcast, and I'm kind of having, and anybody who's been following along, this is not going to be new for me. I have a few, I'll call them hiccups on my list where I'm kind of like, what was I thinking here? And so my number 40 was Steamboat versus Steve Austin from Clash of Champions 20. And so this is a good match. Steamboat kind of controls also on the map from the beginning. It's kind of framed as Steamboat needing to finally pull through because I believe he and Austin had kind of a series of matches going up to this. And Austin is, make sure I'm saying the right title. I want to say this is the TV title. Tyler, am I right on that?
Yeah.
I think this
that's
TV
what I
title.
Have, yeah.
Yeah, TV title. And I believe they had kind of had a series. And that's why I'm wondering, because I enjoyed this match on rewatch, but I'm wondering if I accidentally put this in what I really meant to put in this number 40 spot was the, I believe it's the August 1st one. And I think that's from Saturday night, if I'm not mistaken. And maybe I meant to put that one because I think that might be the better match. Not that this one's bad. This was really good, but I think that other one is a bit, has a little bit more juice to it. This one is cool because you do have Steamboat winning, and that it's kind of a great moment, in how Austin fights through, and he's kind of like, he doesn't want to, he's so committed to not letting Steamboat get this match, and do a good job of conveying that Steamboat is kind of better than Austin. But, and there's more experience, and he's a veteran, and he's probably the more talented wrestler, but Austin is kind of this tenacious young guy. He's cutting corners, using the ropes and stuff, and he just, like, you know, he's using, like, his young, like, fire and energy to kind of maybe meet Steamboat, even though Steamboat probably is the better wrestler, which I think is a cool little storyline. Steamboat has, he's working the ribs throughout the entire match, selling the ribs, I should say. Austin's working the ribs because Steamboat has the rib tape on. There's a really cool spot where Steamboat does a skin a cat, and then Austin just has it scouted perfectly and like knocks him outside of the ring. But then Steamboat finally hits the crossbody and wins it. It is a cool atmosphere too, because this is the 20th Clash of Champions. So there's a lot of like pomp and circumstance by WCW standards, right? So they have a lot of like Brunos at this one, where they do the big red carpet thing. So it does have a cool atmosphere with it being the 20th Clash of Champions. So that's kind of in there too. But I don't know if this is one where I'm thinking back to my list. I'm like, I don't know if this is I don't know if this is on the same level of that Rock and Roll match that we just watched. And like I have said, that maybe my list is not always purely going on what's the best technical match. There's other factors, but I do think this one I do have ranked a little high. So I do have a little buyer's remorse on this one. And I'm wondering if I maybe just put this in and I was in my brain, maybe I thought it was the August 1st, I have that date in my head, the Saturday night match between them, which I think maybe is a little bit of a stronger match.
Okay. So they also had a Clash match in 1994. I think it was Clash 28. Mm-hmm. And that was one of my last cuts on the list. Mm-hmm. So I enjoyed that one as well. So this one finished as match number 188 in the voters list. I thought they did a little bit of a strange thing with it. They did the national anthem, but with the wrestlers in the ring, which seemed kind of strange. Austin was trying to have a kind of a heelish look, and Steamboat, I think, was probably hand over the heart and all that. And then they locked Paulie in the cage, which, I suppose that's a tried and true whatever thing. It always seems kind of silly these days anyway, but and I made the same note you had about the ribs being taped. I thought it was probably a residual injury from Starrcade 84 when he and Tully had the same kind of angle going with the ribs. So, but now we have JR calling us so he can get the JR's barbecue sauce for the ribs. So it's the one to get a plug in for that 30 years beforehand, but whatever. So I did think they had really good action and pacing, and I kind of made a note about Steamboat skinning the cat too, that since he had the hurt ribs, and like you said, Austin, you know, was there to have it scouted and, you know, get right on it there. But, you know, these two were always great, so, you know, it's certainly a good match, no doubt, no question there.
Yep.
All right. Moving along, my number 39 is Lex Luger versus Brian Pillman from Halloween Havoc 1989. And I believe you had this a little bit lower, Jake. I think I have down that you had that at number 86.
Yep, 86.
I will talk about it. The composite vote was closer to you than my ranking. So this finished at match number 73. I had Luger just comes in. He just 89 Luger just oozes this arrogance. He just looks at Pillman in disdain for even getting in the ring with him. And he starts by just kind of throwing Pillman out, but Pillman just jumps right back in and just attacks Luger, you know, almost taking it personally. And he takes over until Luger takes a powder, because to avoid Eric Pillman, Pillman was trying to hit Eric Pillman really early. And Luger kind of runs around the ring, makes Pillman chase him, and jumps in the ring real quick and attacks just as Pillman's getting back in. So he kind of showing that veteran, like he's the wily veteran here, even though he was only a few years into his career. And Luger then controls with his power moves. And he hits power moves to, as Jim Ross said, Pillman's well-defined abdomen. So, yeah, I suppose I can't argue that, but it seemed a little bit strange. So, Pillman hits a cross body for two and then controls with arm bars and arm drags and a drop kick. And then he hits a crucifix for two and then goes back for the arm. Pillman missed a top rope splash, and Luger takes over, sends Brian flying, and then drops a neck first on the top rope and then hits clothesline. He hits forearms and stomps and beats on Pillman and hits a suplex. So they're selling that he's working the back for the torture rack. I just thought that Pillman plays a great white meat baby face and Luger's arrogant heel that uses his power advantage to just keep countering. I thought that they had a good matchup there. They were a good pairing. Pillman counters a superplex into a top rope sunset flip for two. And then Brian hits Air Pillman, but Luger gets his foot on the ropes. Pillman misses a missile drop kick, and Luger hits a stun gun for the win. So there's your finish. I thought Luger really gave Pillman a ton, and he really bumped for him pretty well. I talked a little bit about I like the dynamic these two had, with Pillman as kind of the up-and-coming underdog babyface, and Luger was the arrogant heel. I'm a little like you were on your last match, Jake. I think I might have been a bit high on this. I don't know that I would have it as high. I think there are some matches I had below it that I probably would move up. But, I mean, I think it's got a place on the list. I don't know that I would have it quite so high if I were to do it again. But you know, those seem to always change a little bit.
Yeah, no doubt. But I enjoyed it, too. Like you said, I have it on my list just a little higher. This is it's something I'm sure we're going to get more into as we get into the top part of our list. But this Luger is so great. We've had a few matches with him so far on our list, but I think the best is yet to come, obviously. But like in this one, he's just so great. This era of Luger is just fantastic. I don't think that's a hot take. I think it's kind of a consensus thing with Luger. But like his offense is so varied. It all looks great. It all looks impactful. And like you said, Pillman selling in this match is fantastic. But at the same time, they do a really good job, like you said, to both their credit and especially Luger for giving Pillman enough in this match to make him look like a threat. Because kind of on paper, you really don't think Pillman has much of a shot, I would think. But they do a good job of establishing him and make him look just scrappy enough that you feel like he might have a chance to put it, you know, to get the upset. But then Luger kind of kicks it to the next level with like the aggression, which is awesome. But like, for example, I love the spot where Pillman, like he dodges Luger's clothesline and Luger flies out. It's just such an awesome kind of, to me, like a perfect spot that's indicative of like the smaller guy like Pillman being kind of overmatched, so he has to get crafty. I think it's a cool spot. Like stuff like that really makes you feel like Pillman kind of might have what it takes to put this one away. So I agree, it's an awesome match, even if I wasn't quite as high as on you. But I had these two, I think, at another point on my list as well. I want to say I remember talking about, I think we had the I don't know if it was a clash match or something. I don't know. We've talked about so many matches, Tyler.
Yeah. I think we talked about the clash match, which I also enjoyed. So, yeah. And I do think, like, if anyone is looking to start making their greatest WCW wrestler list, and I know Luger takes a lot of shit, but look at this type of performance, and you know, for his case to be pretty high on that one.
Okay, so we will head to my number 39, which is probably low. I mean, this is still pretty high at number 39. But I have a feeling that the consensus is probably a bit higher on it. So my 39 was the War Games match from Bash 87, which I think most are going to have higher. But I said it pretty high, but you had it much higher, I think. So we'll talk about that one later, right?
Yes, we will talk about that one in an episode to come.
Very good.
So, yeah, so that would take me to my number 38, which is Ric Flair versus Ricky Steamboat from Boogie Jam on 3/17/84. But I believe you have that one higher, Jake.
Yes, I do.
All right.
So my number 38 would be the Midnight Express versus the Fantastics from Worldwide in 88. Which I think, is that the one? I think we're talking about this one later, right?
No.
Oh, later on.
Later. Yeah.
Oh, it's we'll a different Midnight's Fantastics match later on this one. Gotcha.
Yeah, between Midnight Fantastics matchups and Flair Steamboat matchups, it gets pretty tuned. Like, I am not exactly sure where we're at on Flair Steamboat ones in the fall one, but we'll just talk. We'll have more, I'm sure.
Yes, absolutely. All right, so we'll keep going to your number 38, or 37, I guess, at this point.
Yes, my number 37 is Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard versus Lex Luger and Barry Windham from WCW Saturday Night 4/23/88. And I believe you had this one, but lower on your list. I think I have it at 8.
Yeah, kind of similar to the Pillman and Luger matches talked about. I had it kind of in the 80s, and you have it here.
Yep. All right. Well, this match finished at number 84 on the voter composite list. So, again, I suppose that is closer to your list, but I do love this match. So, this is Lex and Barry as the tag team champs after winning the belts at Clash 1 in a match we'll talk about later. JR plays up that Barry and Lex friendship and how they care about each other, and we'll see if that plays into this match. So, the faces control early, of course, and Barry's doing most of the work, but Tully makes a tag, but the ref didn't see it and won't allow it, and then the faces switch without a tag. So I always kind of like when they do that once, just to show that it can be done. Barry slams Arn off the top and gets a figure four, but Tully breaks the eyes and the horsemen take control. My notes actually had takes the eyes, but I assume that was a typo and not whatever bullshit match the WWE had this year. So I think he just rakes the eyes there. Barry holds his own, but the horsemen keep cutting off his tag. Barry makes a tag to Lex, who hits a power slam, then goes for the rack, but gets kicked in the knee, and then it goes to a commercial cut, and coming back from the commercial, Arn hits a DDT, which Ross says is the second one, and he isn't sure he's seen anyone take two. Tully throws Lex outside and hits his shoulder on the railing. So Ross says that Barry and Lex are partners inside and outside of the ring, so I think he's playing up that friendship again, we'll assume. JJ kicks Lex outside, and Barry keeps coming over to help. But Teddy Long is the referee. He keeps running him off, and Lex is still taking his shit kicking. But he kicks out of Arn's spinebuster. Luger is really playing a good face in peril here. Tully puts on a figure four, and then Arn comes in and works the leg. Barry just keeps getting more frustrated and keeps getting in the ring. Luger makes the hot tag, and I do mean a hot tag. They were on fire. It makes the tag to Windham. But, yeah. But he takes a knee to the floor in the process. So Tully goes out and rams Luger into the post while Barry's cleaning house in the ring. Tully low blows Barry to turn the tide, and Luger sets up and he's bleeding, but he's still on the floor as Barry looks to make the tag. And JJ's just in his ear the whole time. He's saying, "I told you he wouldn't be there." Barry reverses his suplex and goes for the tag again, but Lex is still not there. Barry hits a face buster on Arn as Lex crawls onto the apron, and Barry just is showing how pissed he is. He grabs Lex's hand and makes the tag, then power slams Lex into the ring. Lex is holding on to Barry and literally crawling up him, like, you know, if you've seen, like a kid would do to their parent as they are just learning how to stand. He's crawling up. Barry helps him up, only to clothesline him back down, holds up the four fingers. Arn gets the pin, celebrates like he's won the Super Bowl. Barry leaves with JJ. So then, and I added extra points based on all the extracurricular activities after the match. So the Midnight Rider comes in to check on Lex. Sting, Dr. Death, and Nikita are right behind him. And the Midnight Rider's so pissed that he goes back to the dressing room, confronts Barry, swings at JJ, I think. But when he does this, Flair and the rest of the horsemen jump him from behind. They unmask the Midnight Rider, but the baby faces are there now, so they cover up his face as JJ's yelling at the cameraman to follow him to prove that it's Dusty Rhodes. And then Barry leaves in the limo with the horsemen. He holds out the mask of the Midnight Rider in one hand and does the four fingers of the four horsemen with the other hand. I just thought this was a great storytelling match. And I feel like they did cover why Barry had turned. I don't believe that he had any intention of turning on his partner to cost him the tag titles. before the match started. It was all done during the match, and I thought they did a great job of showing that with JJ screaming at him, you know, I told you you wouldn't be there, and that Barry's had this long feud with the Horsemen, and there's kind of a vibe that, well, I guess maybe I can't really beat them, so maybe I should join them. So I enjoyed that storytelling aspect of it. So, Jake, what did you think?
Yeah, it's awesome. The only thing I'll add, I think you covered it pretty well, is it's just a fantastic Barry performance. Like, when I was watching it, that's what really stood out to me. Like, he really shines throughout this, and they do, like you said, they do a fantastic job of telling the story, and I think he particularly really is awesome throughout all of this and gets all of it over, and he's awesome in the ring. Yeah, to me, he was like the MVP of this one. He was fantastic. Love Barry.
Yeah. Yeah, he's awesome.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, so with that, we will go to my number 37, which was another Barry Windham match. So this is Flair and Windham. So this is some nice synergy here, Tyler, because we have a match right after where we can talk about Barry teaming with Flair, which is kind of fun considering the match we just talked about. But anyway, they're going to be facing Eddie Gilbert. And on paper, I guess technically, I should have this as Eddie Gilbert and Mr. X, but we quickly find out that Mr. X is Ricky Steamboat. So, and so the whole way this is framed is that Flair is not expecting this, and they have no idea who Eddie Gilbert's partner is going to be, and it's Steamboat, and so they're really taken off guard by this, and they're not ready for it. And it's a super hot start because the crowd is obviously losing their minds. And this is sort of the start of the entire, correct me if I'm wrong, but the entire, like, 89 Steamboat Flair saga, really, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's a really cool aspect of all this, too. But I love Steamboat in the opening portion. He's, like, taking the heels by storm. Like I said, they weren't expecting him, and they really do a good job of getting that over. And Flair, especially, really shows this frustration. Like, he didn't know, because they're obviously going in real cocky. Like, who's Eddie Gilbert going to get? Like, we're not afraid of anybody. Like, there's nobody he's going to get that's going to be able to keep up with us. And then he actually has a guy who can keep up with them, which is really awesome. And like I said, the way they sell the Horseman's concern is just fantastic. Like, even JJ, I think, is awesome at showing, like, he's kind of scrambling around, not really sure what to do. There's a nice subversion, too, because you're thinking, okay, Steamboat's going to come in hot, and then when Eddie Gilbert comes in, it's kind of going to – that's when the Horseman gets the advantage. But at first, it's kind of not really what happens. Then Eddie comes in. Eddie Gilbert comes in, but he kind of keeps the momentum. So I thought there's a cool subversion to what you would think the formula for the match is going to be, and that he kind of feeds off of Steamboat's energy, even though he's kind of the underdog, and he kind of keeps the momentum going until finally the Horsemen are able to kind of get over on him and get some advantage. So I just love that whole opening portion of the match, because it's kind of expected, but I like that they added that wrinkle of you know, having Eddie Gilbert actually keep the momentum, because, like I said, the conventional wisdom would say that he would start getting his ass kicked almost immediately to kind of slow it down and let the heels get back on top. But they kind of draw it out a little bit further. I love the sequence. As I like Eddie in peril, too, because rather than just him taking a pure ass kicking, it's almost like and it really keeps the crowd into it in that he's getting his ass kicked, but, like, he has some nice pinning combinations. To me, that is, like, his way of trying to make his comebacks, is as they're working him over, he just constantly is pulling out these pinning combos for kind of these, like, semi-near falls, which is really cool, and kind of adds in these little flurries with that, and it kind of makes it to where I think it helps the match not drag. Not saying it would have dragged if they did it that way, but I think it elevates the match and makes it a little more interesting and kind of gets over Eddie Gilbert as sort of a scrappy baby face, which I feel is sort of his character, to have him constantly having these little these flurries and these pinning combinations to kind of keep himself alive. But then Flair just goes, like, next level on him. And I love the way, like, the story of Flair in this match is so fantastic, because he comes in and he's, like, caught off guard, and he doesn't know what to do, and he has no solution. And they finally get some advantage, and he notices that, like, they can't keep Eddie Gilbert down completely. So he just goes, like, next level with the aggression and just really starts hammering Eddie Gilbert. And then he's able to, like, he's not having his little flurries anymore. Then the Horsemen are, like, completely dominating. So I love the way that they got over that Flair just goes next level on him and kind of knows, like basically Flair's tired of Eddie Gilbert's shit, and he's ready to just, like, he wants to end this. Like, he's pissed off that they brought Steamboat in. He's pissed off that he kind of ended up looking foolish in the beginning, and he's finally letting it all out on Eddie Gilbert. But in typical Flair fashion, he also gets cocky, and that allows the tag to Steamboat, who then comes in, and he ends up actually beating Flair and pinning him. And it's a huge moment, like I said, and they kind of sell it as part of this is that, you know, they were cocky, they weren't expecting Steamboat, and it's a fantastic way to kind of set off their feud, because it kind of protects Flair a little bit, because it's a tag match, he wasn't expecting them, whatever, but everybody, I thought, in this match played their roles perfection. Like you said with the last match, Tyler, I just love the storytelling in this one. The way that they had the surprise Steamboat appearance and the way they built to him winning the match. And, man, I just thought everybody played. I mean, Barry's just perfect as kind of Flair's heavy in this, kind of feeding off of him as a tag team. Just play their roles to perfection and just, like, complete excellent execution, both as a match and as the beginning of this story, this angle that they're doing with Steamboat in a Flair that would lead to, you know, obviously where we go. But so I thought everything about it was just fantastic, just perfectly done. It's like what I think you think of when you think of like this era of WCW and just how they did TV, to be able to integrate the angles and like take an angle and make it into a great match and kind of blend that all together is just fantastic. Great stuff.
Yeah, it certainly is. So it finished as match number 93 in the composite voting final results. But I had same thing you were just talking about. What a great bit of storytelling this is. And I like that it combines the story of Wyndham and the Horsemen taking Gilbert too lightly and beating him down. And that's what led to this match with his mystery opponent, or his mystery partner, Mr. X. So then it also combines that with the arrival of Steamboat as a surprise partner. I like that during Steamboat's shine, he's getting a lot of offense. He goes outside and gets on the house mic telling Flair that if you want to play, stay in the sandbox. Flair was kind of running and stalling. So I like that there's getting on the house mic's one extra benefit of the studio wrestling, as well as that intimate, you know, setting that we kind of have talked about in past matches. So it was about this point where I saw that they also have a good supply of wrestling grannies at this point, which they showed one at this point, which I also think is great. Instead of having the, you know, the studio wrestling, we need more grannies in the front row, I think. So, and I thought that, kind of like you said, Eddie Gilbert just put in a great performance as a fiery babyface. He's just so good at this. So, like you said, he got in more offense than you'd expect kind of at the beginning. He put Flair in the figure four at one point before the Horseman kind of did take over. And I made the same note that you did. He had a lot of flash roll-ups and near falls. And I just feel like there's such an art to being a sympathetic underdog babyface without looking weak. And man, does Eddie ever have that. So at one point I'd heard Steamboat had said that part of the art of being a babyface, you take the shit kicking, but I take like three moves and then I do a hope spot. I fire back at least a little bit. I don't just keep getting the shit beat out of me constantly or you lose them. And Eddie has that down. Steamboat has that down. Ricky Morton has that down. Like, you see it a lot in this project. WCW is full of these guys at this time that just were great at that. So, and then, you know, of course he gets to the half peg Steamboat. And he winds up pinning the world champion, establishing himself as a serious threat to Flair's title. And then I just had kind of the same note you did. I wonder if those two will have any good matches later in the year. So I guess we'll see. We'll see if any others make our list.
Yeah, they had a decent shot.
All right, so are we up to my number 36?
We are.
All right, my number 36 is Sting versus Cactus Jack, Falls Count Anywhere, from Beach Blast 1992. I believe you had that a little bit lower on your list, but still on your list. Is that right, Jake?
Yes, it was right at the top or bottom, however you want to say it. I had 97.
Okay. All right. Well, this match finished number 36 on the composite voter list. So I actually ranked this one exactly the same as the voters. And I don't believe that's happened on a match previously for either of us. If it did, I haven't noticed yet. But this one is right where it landed with the voters. So this is Falls Count Anywhere. So neither man makes it to the ring as Cactus just, he stops on the ramp and waits for Sting. He doesn't sneak attack. He just stares him down when Sting comes out. So it looks like two gunfighters at the OK Corral. So they charge each other, and Sting gets a quick backslide and a backdrop and his bulldog on the ramp, but kind of gets over the stip before he goes flying, and he misses a stinger splash and lands on his solar plexus on the ropes. So, and for if we have any new listeners, solar plexus is kind of our code for the nuts. So he lands on his nuts on the ropes. Cactus throws him out and hits the Cactus elbow and neck breaker, and there's no match this time because Watts didn't like them. So that's really a wonder that Mick Foley has made it this long. Because he then hits a sunset flip from the apron. It hits his legs on the rail and his head and back on the concrete for two. Tony mentions that it's non-title here, and I can remember Foley in his book kind of saying that he thought that was kind of stupid because I guess the idea was Texas Jack was so crazy he didn't care about the title, but thought, well, I don't know if that makes him look that great, but whatever. Maybe it made it seem like he could actually win without them putting the title on him. I don't know. Sting rams Cactus into the railing a bunch. Like, that's kind of a perpetual thing. And then he backdrops him over the railing and suplexes him on the floor. And they still haven't made it to the ring yet. So everything I've talked about so far, they have not made it to the ring yet. Cactus flies back over the railing and rolls into the ring. And Cactus takes back over with a regular clothesline and then hits a Cactus clothesline and they're back outside. Jack gets a chair and hits a few shots. And then Sting hits a belly-to-back suplex on the concrete. Sting goes for the splash, but Cactus uses his momentum and Sting hits the railing in like a stun gun kind of thing. He tries a pile driver, but Cactus' knee gives out and he misses a Cactus elbow from the second rope to the outside. Back to the ramp and Sting with chair shots, the last one's to the knee. He goes for the scorpion, but both guys kind of tumble off the ramp. Cactus hits a double arm DDT for two, but Sting hits a clothesline and then goes to the top for another clothesline on the ramp for the win. And then I just had that both of these guys are nuts with some of these bumps that they're taking. What do you think, Jake?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously by the composite list, I'm always feel like I'm a bit lower on this match than most. I do think I may have underrated. 97 was probably too low. I think it should be a little higher, but I would be in the camp that I think in the 30s or so is too high for me. I don't know what it is about this match completely. And rewatching it, that I think what lowers it for me is I love the open. The opening is excellent. Pretty much like the opening, I love everything that happens on the ramp, on the walkway. Because, first of all, you get that classic early 90s WCW walkway, which I love, that I know tons of people are nostalgic for, and it's just, it's awesome. But they utilize it so well. Like, the open is so hot when Sting comes at him, and they go off the ropes. I love any time when they use the, when they kind of go off the ropes into a spot on the walkway, just always pops me in this era of WCW. So I love that. And but anyway, I think what holds it back, and I still think it's a great match. I still love it, but it's just not like this all-time great for me. Like, you know, top 50 match they've ever had or whatever. And I think if I had to say, it's probably, I think that middle portion for me gets a little bit meandering at times. Like, they're so good with the movement and stuff in the beginning and end of the match, but I think it gets into a little bit of sort of just like Cactus taking these sick bumps throughout the middle. And it's fine and all, but it just isn't, I don't know, something about it kind of, it's not quite on the level of what they do in the beginning and end of the match. Like, it just kind of seems like them kind of outside the ring, not quite walking brawl. I think that would be unfair to call it walking brawl, but kind of in that same vein where they're just kind of outside the ring and Cactus is just sort of taking bumps. And it just, something about it doesn't quite engage me as much. I don't know. It's hard to put it into words, but I've just never been quite as big on this match. I still like it a lot. I think it's still awesome. But I guess I'm just not in the camp of it being a like top 40 match or whatever. But and that's the best reason I could think of to convey it, to try and articulate it, I guess.
Yeah, sometimes they just don't connect. And I mean, you're right. It's a lot of.
And you know, sure. the The last thing I'll say is, and it could be suffering from, because there is some Cactus Jack like matches of a similar sort of tone or style that I love so much, and I may be unfairly comparing it to that, and maybe I'm kind of unfairly docking it because it's not those matches. That's definitely in play here, I think. And I think you probably know what I'm talking about that we're going to get to later on down the line.
Yep.
So, all right. So with that, I will go to my number 36, right? Are we at 36?
Yes.
Which will be Flair Garvin from Worldwide, October 3rd, 87, which I think you have higher, Tyler, right?
Yes, I do have that one a little bit higher.
Gotcha. All right. So we'll go to yours.
Go to my number 35 is Ric Flair versus Lex Luger for the NWA title at Starrcade 1988. I believe you have a little bit higher, Jake.
Yes, I do. All right, so with that, I'll go to my number 35, which will be Dick Slater and the Great Muta versus Ric Flair and Sting from Clash of the Champions 8 in September of 89. Tyler, before I start talking about it, did this one, do you have where this one finished on the big list?
Yes, it finished at match 105, which just narrowly missed. So just narrowly missed the top 100.
Gotcha. And I must have given it quite a few points. I don't know. I really like this one a lot. It's a super hot atmosphere. So it's kind of funny. We're just talking about the beginning of the Steamboat's Flair stuff. This is kind of later on in 89. And then we actually have Flair teaming with Sting against Dick Slater and Great Muta, who are like Gary Hart's kind of crew here. So and they kind of frame it that Dick Slater is replacing Funk because Funk's not going to be here. And I think in this match, he does a pretty decent, I think he's a pretty solid replacement for Funk because he kind of tries to do, I think you could say like a great value version of the Funk thing. Like he does a lot of the Funk sort of stooging. So I think he's fine as far as a replacement for Funk in this. He's nuts and he's good and vicious. So maybe not to level Funk obviously, but he's okay. Replacement. Sting is always great as a house of fire, like in this, like anytime he fires up and makes these comebacks. And I think there's the heel face dynamic in this is just really, really awesome. Like they're just such like Slater and Muta are such like dastardly heels. And I'm somebody like I'm not always super high on Muta in WCW, but I think he's fantastic in this match. He really has like some great aggression in this that I really enjoy. Like he comes off as real ruthless. His offense is really, he really lays some stuff in. He seems really motivated here. So I think Muta is really awesome in this as a heel. We get a great hot tag to Flair. I thought was great. I liked how the heels separated Sting from Flair too, leading up to that with some awesome stuff. And really, I think what puts this match over the top for me is the whole ending sequence is just so Sting ends up. Well, actually, earlier in the match, they bring like a roll of coins, and we should mention too that Cornette is on commentary for this, and so that's pretty fun because he's like, what is that? Is that a roll of washers? Is that coins? What is that? So they get a roll of coins, which is, like I said, just some awesome, like absurd heel stuff. And but it works too because Sting survives it, which is cool, and it makes him look tough, but it also kind of changes the dynamic of the match because that's kind of when the heels start dominating. So just every kind of ruthless heel tactic. But anyway, they get to the end and they've been talking about the whole match on commentary about Muta and his spraying, which maybe could get a little insensitive at times when they mention all the Muta stuff at this time can get a little sketchy in the way it's presented. It could be a little, you know, probably not very PC. We'll put it in that. But I forgot to mention too, like I said, every possible little heel tactic, like Slater has the cast. So they use that a lot. Like he hits Flair with the cast and Flair is just bleeding. It's an awesome blade job too. Flair's such a pro, man, because he must have done that blade job in like 3 seconds. Because, I mean, he hits him, he goes to the mat, and he pops right back up, and he's already bleeding. Just like, he must have had that fucking blade, like, right on the edge of his finger, like, ready to rock and roll. Because, like, he doesn't go down for long, and he's, like, immediately bleeding when he comes up. I mean, Flair's so great. But the heels just look so ruthless in the end. Because right after they bust Flair open, things just kind of break down. And it's, like, not... I'd be hard pressed to think of a better, like, heels, just like things breaking down, the heels just going nuts on the baby faces because they look so ruthless. And then we get the all time classic of Terry Funk, who ends up showing up and he puts the fucking plastic bag on Flair's head, which is like the most insane thing ever. Like, he's such a lunatic. I love it. Like, they're loose on commentary. Like, JR's like just losing. Like, he's trying to kill him. What is he doing? And just a fantastic chaotic finish. He gets the branding iron and like breaks it over Sting's leg, or like bends over Sting's leg. And this to me is like, it's a really fun, awesome match throughout. But I think to me, it's just like, I think this is an all time great, like, chaotic finish. Like, I can never, like, I could rewatch this over and over again. Just when Funk comes out with the plastic bag, it's just, to me, that's like top 50 on the list right there. It's just the most crazy, like, and it doesn't come off as like goofy or cartoonish. Like, it looks real. Like, Funk looks like he's trying to kill him. Like, he's such a maniac. It's fantastic. Just some of the best, like, dastardly, insane heel stuff you're ever going to see. I just love that finish so much, Tyler. I could gush about it all day. The plastic bag is just one of the greatest things I've ever seen.
Yeah, so wonderful. Well,
you might not like
it. Really could have killed him like that. I mean, that really worked. No. People are right. Like, it almost is like it doesn't look terribly violent, but it really could kill him. And I, knowing Funk, he probably got it pretty close to doing that. So I don't know. I'm sure they pushed it to the edge. Yeah, so this was a great match. I love JR and Cornette on commentary. From my very first note was they were talking about the different colored mist, and they note that yellow is the most dangerous, but we've never seen it in the U.S. So that was foreshadowing, although I was confused. I'm like, why wouldn't you, if you're going to do that, why wouldn't you always use the most dangerous? Whatever. It was also Ric Flair Day in South Carolina. So made note of that. They made sure to mention that. And he's super over here, so it makes sense. The heat in this was just incredible. And everybody's working really hard. The pace was nonstop the whole time. Cornette and Ross are going nonstop on the commentary, too. Both of them are just talking as fast as they can. And, you know, when one stops, the other one's right there, and they're dropping history, dates, what's going on in the match, putting it over, and it's great. It is nothing like what we've come to know. There's no one talking about building momentum or creating separation or anything, but, I mean, Cornette, he is, like, just pulling specific dates of matches out at any given time, and I made the same note that you did about the hitting them with the roll of coins, and Cornette thought it may have been washers. Now, I don't know what the hell he was thinking at that point, because I've never seen anyone just carry washers in their hand. So, whatever. Maybe, I was doing some home repairs earlier, and, you know, just happened to have this washer. I got to put it back on the light I was installing, so what the hell, I'm going to hit this thing with it. So, but then they do play off the yellow mist. And yeah, the whole bag over the head thing was great. And Sting's knee getting hit with a branding iron. Apparently they said that Flying Brian came out and administered mouth to mouth during the commercial break. So didn't show it. And also, like, Brian, you don't know where Flair's mouth has been. You don't want to do that. Like,
or like that. Why is that the person who would do it? Like, why wouldn't we get, like, a trained EMT or so? Why are we getting them to do it? Like, let the professionals do it. It's so absurd.
They should have, shown that. Like, there's an EMT trying to work on him, asking him questions, Flair's responding, and Brian Pillman just pushes him out of the way and does mouth-to-mouth. So, yeah. And that also may tie in, because I had a note on when Sting got sprayed by the dreaded yellow mist. I said, I believe that blinded him and gave him an unknown venereal disease. So, and he's still probably better off than giving Flair mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. So, but I did want to say this was a great match, and I felt like I may have whipped on it. This was a nice pick, Jake. I think I probably just, I don't know if it just got lost in the whole run in 89. You know, I know I watched it, but it popped for me more this time. So, that was really, really some good, like you said, that chaotic finish really worked.
Yeah, I think, and to your point, I could kind of see what ended up not rating it, because I think without the craziness of the finish, I think it could just kind of come off as, like you said, in 89, maybe get lost in the shuffle. And I think it was just that insanity at the end that really separated from other things. And I totally see why maybe it, you know, why I'm so high on it, because I think some people might not take that into account as much. But it just, it felt so unique to me. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's a great match. I'm going to have that on my list of future watchings then. I believe we are on to my number 34.
Yep.
So, and that is Cactus Jack and Max Payne versus the Nasty Boys in the Chicago Street Fight from Spring Stampede 1994, which I believe you have a little bit higher, Jake.
Correct, because that, if I to peek behind the curtain, that's the one I was alluding to earlier when we did Sting and Cactus, is that this is the match I feel like I was probably judging against, so I have it a bit higher.
I had another one that I thought you might have been alluding to that we'll cover in a future episode.
Yes, there's kind of a tandem, I would say. I kind of have those two in the same regard. But anyway, we'll get to them when we get to them. 34, I have Rey Mysterio versus Dean Malenko from Great American Bash 96. And I will say, I stacked this and my number 33 together because to me, I don't know, forever it made sense in my head to stack them. So I'll talk about the other one in a minute. But yeah, so I was trying to think about what it is I love so much about this pairing with Dean and Ray. And like, this sounds like such a bullshit like kind of thing, but I just love like the rhythm of their matches, like for lack of a better term. I couldn't really think of how to convey it, but I just love the way these two guys work together. They just flow. They just play off of each other so well. Like, they know exactly when to slow down and speed up in their spots. It's to me, it's kind of, and I think Flair is the guy I think of with this, who's like the master of it. He just knows how to work a match and make it ebb and flow, and like how to pace a match really well. And I think it's that same sort of thing of why I love these two guys together so much, because I feel like in this sort of cruiserweight style of match, they know how to do it. They know when to hit the big spots. They know when to slow it down. And obviously, the big thing with them is that it's Ray is kind of more the high flyer, and Dean is more like the, you know, like the Iceman and Master of a Thousand Holds. He's going to bring it to the mat a little bit more. And so that's what he does in this one. He's really all over the arm. And I really like Ray's selling in this of the arm, because he doesn't oversell it too much. He just kind of like early in the match, he's kind of just favoring it at times. Like, you kind of see him holding it. He doesn't overplay it too much. He doesn't make it seem like his arm's broken. He just like has these little moments where he's like, oh man, my arm, which I thought was really good selling. I think sometimes we think of a selling, you got to act like your arm's broken or something, or the limb or whatever is broken. And I thought he did a good, like, subtle job in this one. As Dusty says on the commentary, this is Dusty, all-time great Dusty commentary show, Great American Bash 96, by the way. But he says that Dean is putting Ray in a lot of uncling situations, which is fantastic. It's perfect way to put it, which I believe is what would more commonly be known as submissions, is what he's saying. Working on the mat, pulling in some uncling situations. And Ray, this era of Ray, and like, he would continue to be great for many years after this, but there's something about this like mid to late 90s Ray, like from when he debuts in WCW up until like 98 or so, where just everything he does looks tight. It's just, I guess, because he's at his physical peak. And he would, like I said, he's always great, but man, he is just so crisp in like 96, 97 ish. Like, it's like a thing of beauty. Like I said, the way he works off of Dean and the way they go from spot to spot is just fantastic. But they work a really cool story of Ray's comeback, just getting cut off at the end. And then Dean is able to win it. So I'll talk a little bit more, because like I said, my next match kind of goes hand in hand with this one. But just a fantastic match. Again, maybe a little overrated, but I'm kind of weirdly pairing these, my 34 and 33 almost together, if that makes any fucking sense. But
yeah, well, this was is the more well-known one, I think. Mm-hmm. But and this finished as match number 56 mm-hmm. on the voters list, so I do think it gets quite a boost for being Ray's debut. And I keep going back and forth in my head, well, maybe I should have given it kind of a bump just for that reason. But, and I didn't include this one in part because the next match that you're going to talk about. I do have that one, and I liked it a little bit better. But they're certainly both worthy, and I'm debating whether I should have included both. I guess one thing is I did feel like it was a little one-sided with Demon Patrol for a lot of it, and I did like the arm work, like you mentioned, and at one point, Tene and Dusty say he's going to move like a Code Red, and I don't know what the hell they're talking about there, because it's definitely not the Code Red that I'm familiar with, the flip powerbomb thing that we know is the Code Red, and I'd never heard of a submission called that, but I don't know, I was maybe looking for the arm figure into the finish, but that's kind of a weak criticism, really, because that happens all the time, so I don't know, I think I just picked one.
It's correct.
Match. Yeah.
And that's what I was going to say. They have so many matches together. They kind of fall in that thing where, like, even if you like all of them, like, you get in this situation where you're like, can I really put, you know, how many spots do you want to dedicate to it? So I totally get it. Like, you run into that a lot. Like, it even happened on the GWWE list, you know. It's just the nature of these. When you have guys who've had series together, you're kind of like, man, do I really want to give them, like, 3 to 4 spots on this, even though I kind of like all the matches? You kind of have to pick and choose your favorites and kind of, you know, represent their pairing without taking up too many spots on your list, you know. So I get it, for sure.
Yeah. Okay, so that was 34. So we go to my 33, which was Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard versus Barry Windham and Lex Luger from the Clash of Champions 1. I believe you have a little bit higher, Jake.
Yes, I do.
Right.
All right, so I'll go into my other Dean Ray matchup. Like I said, I kind of put these back-to-back because I thought they went together. So this would be my 33. It's, again, Dean versus Rey Mysterio Jr. from Halloween Havoc 96, which I think is a better match than the one obviously I put it higher. Makes sense, right? But it's a furious open. I really love, like, Dean goes for the cloverleaf really early, and then Ray twists out of it again. Everything they do just looks so, all their spots just look so crisp and natural. It's fantastic. And, like, they go into these reversal sequences that are just, like I said, they're so good at it because they do these reversal sequences that so easily could look, like, choreographed or, like, contrived, but they don't. Like, just the way they put it together, it's sick when you really buy into it. It looks legitimate. Like, it doesn't ever feel fake, for lack of a better term. It feels very natural because you kind of, I think it's because Ray, his athleticism and his quickness is so otherworldly that any kind of crazy reversal sequences he does, you just totally buy into it because you just think he's just a physical, like he's a phenom, and there's just nothing he can't twist out of or physically do. And then Dean's the same way. You kind of bind him as like this technical master. So when they do these reversal sequences, they never come off as choreographed. It's just really awesome stuff. This match definitely feels like more like Ray's pace, which I think is kind of cool to play off this because they're a decent chunk of time away from each other, but still within the same year and sort of within the same feud, I would say. This is really about the mask too, I should say. Like, this whole match is about Ray trying to get his mask back, which he actually does at one point. He gets the mask back and like puts it on in the middle of the match, which is kind of a wild thing to see. Like, I'd be very nervous if I was him that I was gonna like drop it on the ground, but whatever. But his like I said, definitely feels more like a Ray match, where that Great American Bash match felt like Dean controlling the match and kind of working his match more. This definitely felt like Ray trying to keep at his pace and make it quicker, which is really cool. Selling Ray when he does sell on the mat is awesome when Malenko is grounding him. And it's just like the whole story of this match is Ray trying to use his explosiveness to beat Dean, and like Dean just won't let him get the momentum. It's a really cool dynamic, the struggle between those two things throughout this entire match. It's almost like Ray knows, after being against Malenko so many times, like he knows what he has to do to beat him, and so he has to constantly try and, you know, hit these big moves so Dean can't get down on the mat and do his style of match, which is a really cool story. But I was watching this and I just put down, I was like, Some of these pinning combo sequences, fuck, they're just ridiculous. Like, and just same thing like with the reversals. Like, these pinning combos are just otherworldly. Just the way they go through them is just fantastic. I love the near fall towards the end with the power bomb because I thought like that was gonna be it. It's a great near fall because you definitely think Dean's gonna win, but then he finally hits him with the gut wrench at the end, and it's a fitting end that he had to pull out something a little bit extra at the end to beat Ray. It part of me almost wishes Ray would have won, but I'm not going to hold it against the match. Like, I thought it would have been cool if he does use his explosiveness to kind of get over on Dean, but either way, still fantastic stuff. Like I said, I just love these two guys together, and so that's why I decided to dedicate these two pretty high spots to them. I thought this was my way of kind of representing them on the list because it's one of my all-time favorite pairings of two guys.
Yeah, for sure. No, they're a great pairing, and I have the same note that, you know, Ray's speed and aerial moves are strength. He does a great job making them look good in the context of the match, and that's, I think that's why he works better with a guy like Dean or Ultimo Dragon. So, and I have the same note about Dean is still in Ray's mask on Saturday night and attempted to unmask him on Nitro, but Ray took it back and changed masks mid-match, which was just awesome. And Dusty, of course, calling it, saying Ray wants to put the mask on his noggin. So I don't know, I think I just made Dusty Rhodes British there. So in reality, we need Callum, to who wouldn't have that accent, to do Dusty, because he does it amazing. In addition to Dusty's commentary, we have Iron Mike, and I think he's just great at sharing the history in these matches. He said this was fifth pay-per-view or TV match between the two. So I don't know if that was all in WCW or if they faced in ECW or Mexico or anything, but he also stated that Ray may be tired from his international travel schedule. And at the same time, Dusty was making up new English in the commentary of the same match. I think he said he was going to interpretate or something like that. So. And he called attention to it himself, so he wasn't self-conscious about it or anything. So, I think, and Dean did control a lot of this match too, but I do feel like it was, like you said, it was a little bit more of a Ray match. He picked the pace up a little, hit a little bit more bigger moves, and he kind of does a lot of the same things that I was talking about good baby faces doing when they're working from underneath. You know, just you take a little bit of a beating and then you come get hit with a comeback. He just does it with really interesting offense, really flashy, you know, stuff that looks good. But I feel like Ray, it always kind of makes sense, kind of like you were saying. I think he's so fluid that it's plausible that he got out of that with this. It doesn't look choreographed because he's really fluid and he does things that make sense. So, yeah, I agree. It was a lot of really good counters and a really great match between two rivals that have a lot of chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Moving up the list, we're at my number 32, which is the Rock and Roll Express versus the Russians from Worldwide 7/13/85. I think this is another one that we will talk about later. Correct, Jake?
Yes, I have a touch higher, actually.
Very good.
All right. So my number 32 will be, I think, a very well-known match. Bret Hart versus Chris Benoit. This is the Owen Hart tribute match from October 99 on Nitro. So this is a match. I'm not going to go through it like beat for beat. Like, what I'll say is that, so it's obviously a great moment. The entire atmosphere around it is great. And I think what boosts it a bit and why it's kind of, I think for a lot of people, beloved match is just, I think it's kind of regarded as one of the last great kind of WCW or Nitro moments before things kind of start to go down the crapper for WCW. I think they already had started a bit, but like 2000, you know, is... you know, 2000 WCW is kind of infamous, so it's kind of one of their last like really like standout moments before things kind of soured. But anyway, it's, and I think too, it's kind of something to hang their hat on, because I think they're given a lot of credit for almost doing this. And I think it's because they have Brett, you know, so they kind of have the ability to have Brett at a match and do this. But just that that maybe they almost did the Owen tribute better than WWE did. Maybe I think some people would have that. But so you have that with this match. And it's something about this one is it's like I feel like it's like a perfect – the match that they work is perfect for the atmosphere and the situation. It's just – the best word I can think of, it's a very pure match, if that makes any sense. Like, it's just these two guys, both, like, you know, top-level technical wrestlers, just going out there and have a great match. Like, I love the fight in Benoit because he's sort of the underdog in this match because – kind of the feeling of this is like, you're not going to beat Brett in this match. Like, and they do a good job of kind of selling that on commentary. Like, you know, I think Bobby says that, you know, maybe the emotion of this could get to Brett and he might not be on top of his game. And so that's kind of the story they work into it a bit. But you see Benoit fight throughout this match, almost like he's not going to come in and roll over just because, you know, it's Brett and it's in honor of his brother and that sort of thing. Like, he's going to come out there and compete like he normally would, which I think is a cool dynamic. But just, you know, it's almost sort of a face versus face match in a way, but they execute it so well. I just like it. I love the entire atmosphere around it. It's just such a great, technically excellent match, and the way it ebbs and flows and they build throughout to Brett winning is fantastic. And like I said, the thing that really stands out to me is just the way it's just the perfect match for the spot that it was in and what it was supposed to accomplish. I think it was excellent, and it's a great moment.
Yeah, it definitely is a great moment. And see, I had this match at 58, so I'm obviously a big fan as well. It finished number 46 on the final voting. So Harley Race does the intros due to the Kansas City connection, because it takes place in Kemper Arena, where Owen Hart had passed away at the WWF pay-per-view, which I assume everyone knows. But Benoit comes out and he's close to tears, coming out in an Owen shirt. And, you know, like you said, it's just such a technical match with a lot of reversals early, crowds chanting for Owen. And it seems to have this extremely strange kind of eerie feeling to this. And the crowd's kind of silent early, and, you know, they'll chant for Owen, but they're not super into it early. Then things start to pick up a bit as they transition a little bit into, you know, it starts to feel a little more like they do want to win rather than just an exhibition. Benoit hits a nice tombstone and just drapes his arm over, kind of selling exhaustion pretty early. And Brett gets the shoulder up. Benoit is just super crisp, and Brett's selling well and wrestles a realistic style. I did like Bobby asking Tanae if they'd ever wrestled before. And then when Tanae says yes, Brain says, oh, you know, years ago, right? And he's like, well, nope. They wrestled in WCW a couple months ago. So, but, you know, so many things were flying around at that time. Who knows? Who could keep track of it? You know, Brett's working over Benoit's back and tries for the sharpshooter, but Benoit gets a nice counter into the crossface and hits a swan dive headbutt for two. Brett hits a nice pile driver, and Benoit gets his foot on the ropes, but Brett works Benoit into that sharpshooter, and like, I felt like he really cinched it in. Like, you tell he really, you know, locked it in good. And so then Benoit taps, and I kind of feel like this match makes the list both because of and in spite of the circumstances. So, like, the specialness of the night that you kind of already talked about, and the match make it almost a lock, and it was a really good technical match that did fit the mood there. And just at the same time, it kind of almost made the match seem, the actual match seem a little bit insignificant, like felt a little bit like an exhibition. And there's just such a sense of sadness around it. Watching it now with the Owen tribute and what we know about Benoit later, and even what we know about it becomes a Brett's career not long after this match. And so, you know, it's a great match, and I am usually one that can separate all that stuff. I think it was just all three of those things at once just had me thinking, that's a great match, and maybe that's one that I won't be looking to revisit anytime too soon. But it definitely made my list, and makes sense to have on there.
Definitely.
All right. Are we at number 30, my number 31?
Yes, we are.
All right. This is a combination that we had mentioned earlier, and that is the Midnight Express versus the Fantastics. And this particular match is from Pro on March 26th, 1988. So I just love this pairing of these two teams. I mean, I think they had incredible chemistry, and I think that comes across pretty loud and clear. So I've got a few, I put them on my list a few times. This match finished number 76 on the voters list, and it's the Fantastics' debut match in JCP. And it aired the night before Clash 1 and their famous match that we talked about earlier. So the Fantastics, they get good shine. Well, it's their debut in JCP for this run, at any rate, I'll say that. So the Fantastics get good shine segment to establish them, and they outquick the Midnight Express, Ralph says. And, you know, the Midnight Express are just stooging like crazy. Lane at one point charges the corner where Eaton's holding one of the Fantastics, and they move, and Lane ends up monkey flipping Eaton. So that was a little contrived, but the crowd eats it up, and it looked kind of funny. So the Fantastics have the crowd, even in their debut, and there's a lot of talk about the upcoming Crockett Cup, so and the seedings, and of course Cornette's upset about it. Fantastics get a nice double team punch to the gut and knee lift, which sends Eaton outside and right out of his boots, as JR notes. So Midnights are just making them look like $1 million, and they had a really long shine segment. So like this is how you debut a new team. So, the Midnights turn the tide on a blind tag to a backdrop into Stan's karate kick and smug look, followed up by Lane's karate and a drop toe hold, and Eaton comes in and drops an elbow immediately. And one thing I love about the Midnight Express, and we've talked about this a little bit, but it shows up the more matches I watch, is how much they'll stooge and they'll sell. But like the second they get an advantage, they're on their opponent like a shark to blood and just tearing them up then. So Rogers is playing the face in peril, and he's really good at it. So here we go here. So Ross notes that the Midnight Express are great offensive wrestlers, and I couldn't agree more. I think they're really innovative once they take control. Rogers makes the hot tag to Fulton, and he quickly gets double flapjacks, but Rogers saves, and Fulton's now facing peril number two. The Midnights do a nice spot where they swing him. All I can say is they swing Fulton like he's a jump rope. They each have, one of them has a hold of him, their head, and one of them has a hold of the feet, and Cottle claims they had the hair. But I thought that was a really unique spot. And the Midnights hit two leapfrog cross bodies, which I absolutely love that move that they do. Fulton gets his foot on the ropes, and the double team clothesline for another two. Eaton hits the top rope elbow for two, and Ross explains, I ain't believing it. But, if he had listened to our last episode, he'd know that if Eaton hits the Alabama Jam, it's a finisher. But if he hits anything else from the top, not so much. So we'll have to keep tracking this theory going forward. But regardless, it won't diminish my love for Bobby. And he will finish high on my GWCW wrestler voting. Because he's awesome in this match and in almost every match that he's in. Lane throws Fulton over the top, which would have been a DQ if the ref saw it, as Ross notes. And I don't really like that rule, but that's a good use of that rule. That's why you do it. So when the ref's not looking, the heel throw the baby face over and get more heat there. Ross notes that the Midnight Express is cooking on all four cylinders. And again, I just like the Midnight because they can get a little long shine, but then get the heat really quickly because their offense is just tremendous. They get the hot tag to Rogers, and he comes in, and he's just a house of fire. The finish comes pretty quickly as all four men are in. Rogers gets thrown outside, and the Midnight try a rocket launcher on Fulton, but Rogers saves, so Eaton just splats on the mat. The ref gets Stan out, and the Fantastics hit a rocket launcher onto Eaton for the upset win. So they hit the Midnight's finisher on them, and the fans just go batshit. I mean, they were with them the whole time.
Yeah, it's so I think the only reason I probably didn't have this match is because I honestly probably didn't watch it for when I was putting my list together, just because there's just certain things I didn't get to. And unfortunately, I think like the pro worldwide stuff was probably at the bottom of my list. There were some that I went out of my way to make sure I watched because they have notoriety. But unfortunately, I think it's just a matter of doing these lists is that it's a seemingly endless list of things to watch. I think this one just kind of slipped through the cracks because, man, this is damn good. Like, it definitely is not the quality of it. Would not be why I didn't have it ranked, because the Fantastics, like, they were kind of a discovery for me in doing this list. And their early shine in these matches, like, when they come in so hot. Like, in every match I watch for the list, like, they're so good at coming in and kind of getting the early babyface advantage, like, shine sequence. They're just, like, masters of it. And they always look so awesome in it. It's such a hot start to the match, and they immediately get the crowd into it. It's a really awesome way to start the match. And, like you kind of covered it, just watching this match, all I could think was like, man, this is just incredible tag work. Just the way that they go in and out and the way they work the spots. And like, it just feels like it's such like it is tag wrestling. Like, I feel like this is like the platonic ideal of like this 80s NWA WCW wrestling is like in this match. I feel like it's a fantastic representation of it because it is just sorry, I just said fantastic in a fantastic match. So pardon the pun, but it's so great. Like you said, the Midnights, I'm with you too. Bobby, he was not a discovery for me because I always have loved Bobby Eaton. He is just, I mean, it only made me love him more doing this, but man, he's just, it almost just feels like second nature to him. Like he just, there's actually, sorry, I forget what podcast was. I think it was like Tony on his pod said before that, you know, they wanted Bobby Eaton to be like a teacher at the power plant or some shit like that. And he basically like couldn't do it because as good as he wasn't a good teacher because he could like never explain like why he did the things he did in the match. It was just kind of like he just knew. It was like all instinctual for him. And I think it comes through when you watch him because he's just everything just is so well timed and he knows the exact right thing to do. And in every moment, it's just, man, these two, this was great. Like I said, the only reason I didn't rate it was probably because I honestly didn't watch it. And I wish I would have, because it definitely would have made my list probably pretty high like you had it, Tyler.
Yeah. And as much as the Rock and Roll Express and Midnights are lauded as this great pairing, and I think they are. That's like pizza. I could watch every match they have and it's all good, you know. But I think the Midnights and the Fantastics had even better chemistry. Then your story about Bobby not being able to teach at the power plant as much, that reminds me of, I think it was Barry Bonds was trying, they tried to be like a hitting instructor and he couldn't do it because he was just like, well, you just do this. Why can't you do that? Like, because mm-hmm. I'm not one of the greatest hitters of all time. Like you are. I'm sorry. I see what you're saying, but I just can't do that. And I think maybe like, I think Magic Johnson tried to do the same thing. Why can't you just make this pass? Well, I'm not a 6'9" point guard. That's why, you know. So it's probably the same thing with Eaton. As far as tag team wrestlers, he's as good as those guys were.
So good. All right, so I guess that leaves us at my number 31, and that we'll close out this episode, which with a Flair Steamboat match. So it begins. Sorry, Sean Kidd. This is his nightmare. Is going to be the top of these lists. Start getting these Steamboat Flair matches. But this is actually the Flair Steamboat match from 94 at Spring Stampede. The one that preceded the Saturday night match that I think you had. That I probably should have had on my list somewhere. But yeah, this one, I really enjoy this, and me and JT actually covered this at the very beginning of the project. It's kind of a weird time capsule because that was also like right as the world was about to shut down. I feel like me and JT recorded that live watch like literally within a week of everything shutting down. Like a week later, everything would shut down due to COVID. So it's kind of a weird time capsule. Like I kind of remember us talking about everything in between doing the pod. But anyway, we live watched this one for this project actually, and yeah, I really love this one because it kind of sets, I mean, obviously both guys are a bit older than they were in the classic trilogy and all that sort of stuff and a lot of their other matches. And it's really kind of the end of the road for Steamboat as his career would pretty much be over for a pretty long time after this. But I kind of love this one because it has a different energy to it than a lot of their other stuff. It's a bit slower in a good way. Like, I kind of like that they work a little bit of a... you know, a more methodical pace, for lack of a better term. But it's just like, it's them doing, going through their classic, like their normal motions, but it just feels a little bit slower. They definitely have a vibe of like, it's two veterans going at each other, but there's some great stuff in this match. And it also has a face-face energy to it, which is very interesting for these two guys because otherwise it's been really heavy, like Flair's the heel, Steamboat the face kind of thing. So I think that's a cool dynamic to it too, is that it kind of, I think there's a different way where it just kind of seems like two athletes, and Flair kind of plays a little bit of a de facto heel in it. But man, there's some great stuff in this. Like I always love the spot in this match where it's like a really subtle thing. You might not notice it. Where Flair kind of it's like he's recovering on the outside, and then he sees that Steamboat's coming to like off the top rope on him, and he lays back down, and it's like he's goading him into it, which is just awesome Flair stuff. And there's so many little moments in this match, and they definitely play into like these two guys knowing each other, knowing each other's tendencies. And it's just like I said earlier, with Flair, and what I think is, it's a thing that always stands out to me that I think is a big reason why he's so great, is that he just knows how to sort of pace these matches. And I feel like this is a fantastically paced match. Like, it just builds so well. Like I said, it's a little bit slow, but they just slowly build up the spots into a crescendo at the end. It's just fantastic stuff. And I just like how it's unique compared to, because I think one thing you have to say about maybe some of the more famous matches, the trilogy and stuff, is that sometimes it can be hard to distinguish some of them, maybe, in the style that they work and stuff. But I like this one that it's a little bit different. So, yeah, I don't know. I just really like this one. I think it's a good one to have as maybe my first Steamboat Flair match on the list. I think you had it a bit. You had it on your list, too, but maybe not as high as me. Right, Tyler?
Correct. I had it at 74.
Mm-hmm. Where did this one, do we have where this one ended up on the composite list? You didn't say it yet, did you? Hopefully not, and I'm just spacing.
I have not said it, and we do have it. It is match number 33. this was also my first Flair Steamboat match on the list, but not the last. And I have since talked about at least one other one, two other ones, I believe. So... I am about to lose track, but it was a babyface respect match as well, and that the announcers note that Steamboat has got booed, and again, they all play up that history. He won his first TV title from Flair, play up the U.S. title and world title history, and like you mentioned, it's a different feel than the 89 matches. It's got a technical start, but a slower pace, and at one point, Steamboat kind of starts working the headlocks like he does in some of those 84 matches, but that doesn't last as long, so that's not the story. So they incorporate all those other elements. Some might say even the greatest hits, but I wouldn't take that as a negative at all. I mean, I think that's what you do when you have a hit. You incorporate what has worked. So, and I always loved getting the greatest hits albums or CDs back when they were a thing, because then you only had to buy those. You didn't have to buy three or four. So I don't consider that a criticism. So, I mean, I just think like you said, it's a really smartly worked match. I always like how they keep bringing up Flair's back from the plane crash. That was in 74, I think, and it's 20 years later, but they would still do it in his WWF run, I believe. So there's WWE run. So, and at one point, Steamboat gets Flair in the double chicken wing, which is what he won the title with in 89 in one of the two out of three falls. If, you know, I don't know if we'll get a chance to talk about that match, but spoiler, we probably will. So, Flair falls to his knees. And they do the double pan with both men's shoulders down. So that leads to the rematch on Saturday night. Yep, another great match. Turns out these two guys are pretty good, and they work pretty well together.
Absolutely. But I think that wraps us up for this chunk, Tyler. We rolled through these pretty quick.
Yeah, I think that'll do it for this episode. So I would just thank all of our listeners and encourage you to be watching for the results rollout, and it should be coming to a conclusion this Friday, I believe. But you can check it out on placetobenation.com, and if you can find it, and if you haven't been following along, you can find the archives and check out the matches that have already dropped, and also join the Facebook page for this year's Stretch Project, which, as we've mentioned a time or two, is the greatest WCW wrestler of all time. So it ties in nicely with this list and this podcast series that we're doing, Jake. So what do you got going on?
So I have very soon, I think after this pod drops, we'll have a new episode of PTB NXT. We're actually covering a TakeOver Fatal 4-Way. So we're up to another TakeOver, finally. Felt like an eternity that we're building to that. So we have that going on. As always, I'm on North-South Feed doing Ruthlessly Aggressive podcast, covering the fallout from SummerSlam 02 now. And then also check me out on Highway to the Impact Zone, where we will soon be covering Final Resolution 05 over in TNA. So always interesting to talk TNA. But like Tyler said, be sure to engage with the new project. I think if you did this one, I think if you didn't do this one and you're listening to us talk about it, or, you know, have been looking through the list, I think it is I think just thinking about this match list is a good way to get the wheels turning on the wrestler list. I think they go kind of hand in hand. So it's a pretty good how would you say that, like, synergy? I'm always say that. That's a good word for having these two projects back to back. But check it out. I know we always say, Tyler, but you put a ton of work into these. Like, I made the list, I'm talking about it. But as far as the actual legwork of compiling the list, and you're always on the Facebook page kind of posting the discussion threads for different wrestlers and stuff. You are kind of like the engine that keeps these projects turning. So everybody check it out, because Tyler really does do some excellent work with these things, and it's really, really fun. I'm really looking forward to this top 30, because we've gotten to some heavy hitters on this one, and we're only going to get into more as we get into this top 30. This is where we start really getting to the, like, classic, like, man, just matches that you look at and you just want to, like, gush about them, because it's so, I had a few on this one where I was starting to get into that mode. So I'm really looking forward to this final 30, Tyler.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, make sure you check out the other podcasts on the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, where you find this one. And there's just a lot of great content on there, both the main event, the NWA Saturday Night Special, the Pro Wrestling Love Countdown. And I'm going to forget more than I can remember, but there's just a lot of good stuff going on there. So make sure you check that out as well.
Very good. But for myself and Tyler, this has been another fun rundown. Please come back for our next episode as we really get into our final, the final third of this list. And it's been a blast, Tyler. I'm looking forward to talking these top 30. But that's all we got. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you at number 30. Peace. You're like a dream come true. Just want to be with you. It's plain to see that you're the only one for me. And four repeat steps, 1 through 3, 5.
work themselves out. And all emotional, once you know what it's all about. Hey, and undesirable for us to be apart. Never would have made it very far. 'Cause you know.